Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics, and somewhat unusual format for today's show. Most of it taken up with a long interview with the political scientist Robert Faton, or Robert Fatton, if you anglicize it, as he does sometimes, who teaches in the political science department at the University of Virginia. Faton is of Haitian origin, although he's been in the United States for about the last three decades, and he has a lot to say about the history and social structure of that unfortunate country. I had him on the show back in 2004 to talk about similar things, the social structure and history of Haiti, when Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the elected president of that country, was chased out as a sort of joint venture of the Haitian ruling class and the United States, the George Bush administration. Now, 6 years later, 5 or 6 years later, Haiti struck by a terrible natural disaster, but a natural disaster whose effects have been greatly compounded by the political and social crisis that has characterized Haiti for, many, many, many years, many, many decades. So, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Robert Faton on all that. First, some comments. First, in the economic news, more stumbling along the bottom. On Thursday morning, the Labor Department, not, by the way, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the main source of data in that agency, but in this case, the Employment and Training Administration, another division within the department, sorry to go all geeky on you, they reported that first-time claims for unemployment insurance filed by people who've just lost their jobs rose by a sharp 36,000 last week. The department said, however, that this rise was mostly the result of a holiday-related processing delay and not the sign of labor market deterioration. We shall see. The decline in initial claims has been one of the brighter spots on the economic landscape, so if this isn't just a blip, there is reason to worry. The count of those continuing to draw jobless benefits, the so-called continuing claims series, extended the downtrend it's been in since June. While that's good news, cheer must be tempered by the fact that this regular count doesn't include those drawing emergency and extended unemployment benefits. If you add them in, there's hardly been any decline at all. The share of the unemployed accounted for by the very long-term jobless is at record levels, which underscores that this is more a systemic crisis than a merely cyclical one. In happier news, the Conference Board's Index of Leading Indicators, which forecasts trends in the economy 3 to 6 months ahead, rose for the 9th consecutive month in December. That's further confirmation the recession is over and a weak recovery is underway, but I'm still thinking that we've got a rough year ahead of us. The economy isn't the only thing suffering from a structural and not merely cyclical crisis. Our political system is as well. I quickly got tired of hearing all the liberal anguish over the result of the Senate race in Massachusetts. The Democrats brought the problem on themselves. A year of trying to seduce the Republicans into bipartisanship and giving the conservative wing of the Democratic Party everything they want has brought Obama nothing but disrepute. For hardened street fighters like the GOP, conciliation is a sign of weakness, which only makes them bolder. Of course, the liberal instinct is to blame the urge to compromise on the lack of brains or some other crucial bodily organ in the Democratic Party. I think that's wrong. The fundamental problem of the Democrats is that they're a party of capital that has to pretend for electoral reasons that it's something else. So they make progressive noises to satisfy the base, but once in power, do the bidding of their funders. Sometimes these contradictory tendencies can be seen in one figure, like Obama himself, and sometimes in the wings of the party, e.g. the Progressive Caucus and the Blue Dogs. But in both cases, the more conservative faction, whether of personality or party, almost always prevails. That's especially the case when there are no popular movements pushing them in a better direction. Those popular movements were partly disarmed by Obama's victory. Maybe they'll start coming to their senses now, especially as the Dems move right in response to the Massachusetts debacle. But that's not the whole story. Although a lot of liberals and even more serious leftists don't like to admit it, there's a deeply conservative streak in the American electorate. The common sense, that is the unschooled instincts imparted by upbringing and inherited ideologies, of the people in this country is individualist and self-reliant. That common sense has become increasingly dysfunctional. The U.S. reminds me in many ways of a startup company that's grown so big that it needs a serious overhaul but is incapable of the necessary transformation. In the corporate example, you frequently see that the founders don't want to turn things over to professional managers. They want to keep running the show and instinct and animal spirits, but those aren't working anymore. So too the U.S. The dog-eat-dog model of social Darwinism worked well while the U.S. was growing rapidly in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Worked well on its own terms, of course, was highly brutal. But ever since growth slowed in the 1970s, we've been in need of a rethink of the old model, but we're incapable of it. Instead, we've tried ever more reckless applications of debt to keep things going. The recent financial crisis looked like the crisis of that approach, but we're now emerging from the crisis phase without things having changed all that much. Obama's making some hostile sounds about breaking up the large banks and putting their speculative activities on a leash, but I'll believe that when I see it. The country seems to be rotting from within, but the political and ideological systems are incapable of recognizing that fact, much less trying to deal with it. I wish I could detach myself from the consequences and find it all amusing in the style of H.L. Mencken, but I can't, and now I've got a kid who was born into this nut house. I hope we can get our act together and make this a less brutal place, but it's hard to get hopeful. I guess this is what it's like to live in the midst of imperial decline. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Haiti. And that was some of the prelude number 14 in E-flat minor, Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Keith Jarrett, and somewhat mournful music accompanying today's show because when talking about Haiti, it seemed inappropriate to have any kind of punkoid noise or hip-hop disruption. So I thought something more mournful, perhaps, was in order. Anyway, the main guest on tonight's program is Robert Fatton, who is the Julia Cooper Professor of Government and Foreign Affairs in the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia. He's the author of many books and a number of scholarly articles. The books include Black Consciousness in South Africa, which came out in 1986, The Making of a Liberal Democracy, Senegal's Passive Revolution, came out in 1987, Predatory Rule, State and Civil Society in Africa, of 1992, Haiti's Predatory Republic, The Unending Transition to Democracy, came out in 2002, and his most recent book from 2007, The Roots of Haitian Despotism. He was born and raised in Port-au-Prince and has studied in France in the 1970s, but has been in the United States ever since the mid-1970s and is now an American citizen. And he has been teaching at the University of Virginia since 1981. And I thought there was no one better equipped to give us a really deep background on the situation in Haiti. It's certainly experiencing a major natural disaster and unimagined suffering and death, but that natural disaster has been severely compounded by the social problems that have afflicted Haiti for the last couple of centuries. So, interview recorded earlier this week with Robert Faton. Welcome. I really am speechless about the events in Haiti over the last week. I don't know what really to say, but obviously this is a very large natural disaster, but it's not only a natural disaster. How much of a social disaster is it? What produced this kind of devastation aside from the movement of the earth?
Well, as you said, this was really, truly a cruel hell, and it's still a cruel hell for most Haitians. The devastation, obviously, is caused by the earthquake, but there's much more to it, as you put it. And the much more to it is essentially the incapacity of the government to deal with such a crisis. And at the same time, the incapacity of the UN to deal with it. And this is really the result of the past 20 or 30 years. What we have is a state that is essentially irresponsible and incapable of delivering the most basic necessities to the population. And this has domestic roots, but it does also have external roots, in particular in terms of the plans that the IMF and the World Bank have implanted in Haiti, the so-called neoliberal regime. And what we have is a state that has been emasculated and a multiplicity of NGOs which were supposed to supplant the state. And while most NGOs are indeed doing some good work, they are not very coherent units in terms of their capacity to reach across the nation, and they tend to be, without being cruel, palliatives to the fight against poverty. What we need in Haiti is really a functioning state, and a state that is capable of dealing with that emergency, and unfortunately we don't have it.
Has Haiti ever had a functioning state in the sense that first world people would think of it?
Well, it's a good question, but what is striking is, as you may recall, 2 years ago we had the horrible hurricanes in Gonaïves, and you would think that the government after that crisis, and actually the United Nations, the so-called Stabilization Forces Minister, would have had made plans for the possibility of another catastrophe. Granted that the earthquake was completely unexpected, although we sit on a fault line, but you would expect that there would be centers of emergency. If you look at the earthquake, it is absolutely true that it has been devastating, but it's really in the capital city, and in the southern town of Jacmel, so the whole area of Port-au-Prince and Jacmel. But the north of the country has been really virtually unaffected, and yet there is nothing that is organized in the north that can come to the rescue of the capital city. And that, to me, is absolutely shocking, that you don't have institutions, basic institutions, to come to the rescue of another part of the country. If that had happened in Cuba or in Jamaica, the catastrophe would have been great. But I don't think that sense of a stateless nation would have, in fact, materialized. And we've been very lucky to some extent in spite of that disaster, because at one point we feared the possibility of a tsunami, and that would have essentially killed probably 3 million people.
There's apparently no functioning physical infrastructure either. The port has collapsed. The airport seems crippled. It's not just a question of the social infrastructure, but the physical infrastructure as well, isn't it?
Yeah, everything has collapsed. I mean, and we are lucky to the extent that the airport, you can land there. The tower was not functioning, but in the last few days, the U.S. Has been able to use some technological device to reestablish the functioning part of the airport. So you can land in Haiti, but the port is really a disaster. The huge cranes that you usually see at ports have collapsed. They are in the water, and part of the port itself is underwater. I mean, I've watched some of the pictures from space, and it's absolutely earth-wrenching.
Let's talk a bit about what the IMF and the World Bank have been up to in the last couple of decades in Haiti. It's not like Haiti was, say, like the Eastern European countries or Latin American countries where there was a national development regime that was dismantled. There was a welfare state of some sort that was pared back. Haiti has long had a very minimally functioning state and a very weak economy, very almost absent, almost lacking a productive economy. So what exactly has the IMF prescription been the last few decades in Haiti?
Well, you're right there. But on the other hand, in particular in the last 30 years, what has happened and that has contributed to exacerbate the crisis is the policy that is practically a policy that is against the agricultural sector of the country. What I mean by this is that not only do you deal with the typical neoliberal agenda, the withdrawal of the state, the privatization of everything, but you have in Haiti, in particular since the late 80s, the destruction, for instance, of local food production. We used to be self-sufficient in terms of rice, and self-sufficient also in terms of sugar. And yet, given the policies that have opened up the economy completely, what we see is the import of very cheap, unsubsidized American rice into Haiti. And that has meant that local production has declined significantly. The same is also true for sugar. So on the one hand, you have the international financial institutions telling Haiti to open the economy, cut subsidies, and yet the U.S., which subsidizes its own rice and its own sugar, is exporting that to Haiti and at the same time creating that crisis in agricultural production in the country. So you have those kinds of paradoxes. You also have to deal with the fact that there has been a consistent plan to bypass whatever was left of the state in order to channel foreign assistance to the NGOs. And that, in turn, has exacerbated the problems that have traditionally been associated with the state. So we have an emasculated state. We have an agricultural sector which is in complete disrepair. There has been no attention paid to the agricultural sector. And that in turn has generated that massive exodus to Port-au-Prince. Port-au-Prince was built for about 300,000 people. Port-au-Prince must have by now 3 million people. So this is an extreme crisis generated not only by incompetent governments, but also by policies designed abroad and imposed on the country.
Who are the NGOs exactly that you've been talking about?
Oh, we have all kinds of NGOs in Haiti. We have the NGOs that are local. We have NGOs that are created by a panoply of churches, and many of them do good work, but they are not centralized in the sense that each does whatever it wants. The government does not control them. They can enter the country and they can do as they please. So there is no systematic planning of development, no coherence to a national vision of what the country should be. So this is very problematic because you don't have that kind of planning that is so required for any type of self-sustaining growth in the country.
Did Haiti ever have a moment, as many countries did in Latin America, of import substitution and national developmental state?
Well, we tried that, actually, but that didn't last very long. It was attempted to some extent under Estime. It was a very short attempt. And what is quite interesting is that at that time, you're talking about the late 40s, early 50s, the country was more or less at the same level of development as the Dominican Republic. It actually might have been a little bit more advanced, which is surprising. But that tells you what has happened since then, because the Dominican Republic is really on the same island, but a completely different country, in spite of the fact that it's still a relatively poor society, but it is way beyond Haiti in terms of economic development and in terms of giving to the population some basic
I'm speaking with Robert Faton, who is a professor of political science at the University of Virginia. What happened to Haiti in the last 40 or 50 years that it fell so far behind its neighbor?
Well, to some extent, you have to look at the Duvalier period. Under Papa Doc, it was simply a predatory state. Very little was done in terms of creating any infrastructure. The corruption that existed was the type of corruption that led to the export of whatever resources we had abroad. You stole the money and you sent it to foreign banks. So it was a qualitatively different dictatorship than the one that you had in Trujillo in the Dominican Republic. However crooked and murderous it may have been, it nonetheless reinvested the money stolen in the country. There was an infrastructure left in the Dominican Republic. When Duvalier left, there was absolutely, well, there was usually nothing. The only major things that were really generated in about 30 years in power was the airport that we have in Port-au-Prince and the dam that generates part of the electricity in Haiti, and that's Pélig. But after, there was little after that. So you're talking about a record of desolation, as it were, insofar as the infrastructure is concerned.
Now, I'm sure the contrasting histories are not just the result of personalities. There must be something in the social structures of the two countries that produce these divergent results. What might those be?
Well, the social structures, in particular the historical legacy, one would need to go back to the colonial period, really. In a paradoxical way, Haiti was the very wealthy part of the island during the colonial period, and the Dominican Republic was under the control of the Spanish up till very late in the ballgame, insofar as the French recovered the Dominican Republic just before Haiti became independent. But the two stories are paradoxical, because during the colonial period, we're talking about the 1700s, early 1800s, Haiti was the richest colony in the world. Dominican Republic was quite poor. The type of labor that was used in Haiti was really slave labor based on the plantation economy. And that meant that the wealth created in Haiti was a wealth derived from sugar and from slaves. The paradox, obviously, is that once Haiti became independent, once the slaves gained their independence, they were no longer willing to remain slaves. So the plantation economy, to some extent, collapsed, and the peasants in Haiti got their small plot of land. In addition, the social structure was also deeply divided in terms of class, in terms of race, and you had a military instinct that had been developed during the Revolutionary War leading to independence. And that, paradoxically, also created militaristic reflexes, very authoritarian reflexes. And I think that tradition has lived on and has exacerbated many of the problems in Haiti compared to the Dominican Republic. So the very fact that the Dominican Republic was not totally exploited gave it more space, social space. Then you have the racial question that no one can ignore. Once Haiti got its independence, we're talking about a white supremacy world economy at that time. Haiti became a pariah nation. The Dominican Republic considered itself always as being part of the European world, and that gave it some freedom, in spite of the fact that at one point Haiti had conquered, as it were, the Dominican Republic from the 1820s to about the 1840s. So those are two different stories, two different class structures, and differences also in terms of the nature of the dictatorship. So those structures are quite significant, and the peculiarities of two major dictatorships were such that one, in spite of its violence, the one in the Dominican Republic, was capable of developing an infrastructure. The one in Haiti did not. And that contributed to that huge gap between the two nations that we see now.
Haiti was also rather severely punished for having mounted a successful slave rebellion, right? The world punished Haiti.
Yeah, this is what I mean by a fundamentally racist world economy. The United States recognized Haiti only when Lincoln was in power, and I think it was the official recognition, if my memory is correct, is 1863. And in addition, the French threatened the Haitian government and forced Haiti to repay a significant debt. And that debt was in payment for France's recognition of the independence of Haiti.
Right. Haiti was forced to pay the French for the loss of the value of the slaves,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah. So, that symbolizes, as it were, the relationship between Haiti and the major powers at that time. And then you obviously have, from 1915 to 1934, the American occupation, which was typical gunboat diplomacy. Very much like in the other Central American countries, what you had was the development of a national army, which eventually became one of the most despotic and reactionary armies in Haiti. And that army was, to a large extent, not really defending the country, but attacking its own population.
What did the United States do in Haiti in those 20 years of occupation?
Well, there was some construction in terms of some roads. There was the establishment of some semblance of a bureaucracy. But it was basically to reestablish what the U.S. considered to be a necessity for Haiti, and what that was order, and for the Haitian government to pay its debt to American banks and American businesses. So it was really a very nasty occupation and a very racist occupation. There is that very famous word from the Secretary of State then, who said, "Oh my dear, Negroes speaking French." And that encapsulated really the U.S. feeling about Haiti at that time, that they were essentially barbarians, curiously speaking French.
And then when the United States left in the mid-1930s, what then happened?
Then we have a series of civilian regimes and kind of bizarre elections, and eventually that culminates in 1957 with the election in a very peculiar electoral process of François Duvalier Bébédock. There was a period with Estimé, which was moderately successful for about 4 years, but then things started falling apart.
And that the voice of Robert Fatton, or Robert Fatton, if you want to anglicize it, who is a professor of political science at the University of Virginia and of Haitian origin, although he's been in the United States about 30 years. My name is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News, and let's take a little break, and then we'll be back to hear more from Fatton.
Centric Productions and Wake Up Call present Haiti through the lens of the media. Explosive, dangerous, deadly, scary, devastating images, dangerous language, controversial content. Coming out to the Brecht Forum for an all-women media panel next Wednesday, January 27th at 8 p.m. Join April Silver, founder and president of Aquila Worksongs, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Karen Hunter, and professor at Hunter College, Bhakti Sringapore, with me, your host and moderator, Esther Armour. For more info, contact 212-209-2812. That's 212-209-2812. Haiti through the lens of the media.
And you're listening to WBAI, 99.5 FM in your radio dial in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, please do hit that donate button. We'll be starting some serious fundraising in a couple of weeks. But in the interim, pump up our cash flow. Okay, let's take a musical break and we'll be back to hear more about Haiti. That a bit of the Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima by Krzysztof Penderecki with the Polish Radio National Symphony Orchestra under the composer's direction. And now we'll return to an interview recorded earlier this week with Robert Faton, who is a professor of political science at the University of Virginia and author of a couple of books on Haiti, his country of origin. Okay, Robert Faton. Okay, let's move forward a couple of decades. And when we last talked, Aristide had just been chased out of the country. What has been happening in Haiti since Aristide's forced removal?
First, you had the creation of an interim regime led by a fellow by the name of La Tortue, who became the prime minister. And you had, for a short while, American troops and French troops in the country. Those troops were eventually replaced by MINUSTAH, which is the UN peacekeeping force. And MINUSTAH is essentially composed of Latin American troops. There are a few Asian troops, but the main contingent comes from Brazil and Argentina. So once MINUSTAH was put together, there was an election. That election was very controversial, and René Préval became the president. Préval had moved away from Aristide and Fermi Lavalas, Aristide's party. One should also clarify things, that Fermi Lavalas at that point was completely disorganized because Aristide was in South Africa. So Préval, who had served as prime minister of Aristide and who had been president from 1995 to 2000 and had been called in Creole Marasa of Aristide, that is to say the twin brother of Aristide, well, he distanced himself from Aristide gradually. But during the election, he nonetheless got the massive support of people who would have voted otherwise for Lavalas. Once Préval became president, the situation started to stabilize. The violence in the slums was to some extent reduced, and the government started to embark on a new kind of neoliberal economic project. That was very much disturbed 2 years ago by a series of natural catastrophes and by food riots. And immediately after those events, the UN and the United States, fearing that things might fall apart completely, started to pay much more attention. This is how Bill Clinton was named as the special envoy to Haiti by the UN. And there's been a lot of attention paid by Clinton to Haiti in terms of bringing foreign investment. And finally, more recently, you had the UN coming out with a new plan, the so-called Collier Plan for Haiti. It's kind of an emergency plan, but it is basically a recycled neoliberal plan for Haiti. And the idea was that Haiti would use its very cheap labor to export textile to the United States. There was the so-called Hope II agreement whereby Haiti would get some preferential tariffs so that those goods could get into the U.S. So very much the same kind of process that we saw actually under Jean-Claude Duvalier. There was also the beginning of more investment in the tourist industry. But the state of the economy was nonetheless very precarious. We were going to have an election this year. It's probably not going to happen. And the elections created new political divisions and, to a large extent, the complete disintegration of the Lavalas movement, because the Lavalas party was banned from the election. And that meant that several factions are moving in multiple directions. That's where we were, more or less, before the earthquake. A fairly stable political system, reduced violence, kind of a renewal of a neoliberal project, and then the earthquake.
I want to return to Lavalas in a second, but is cheap labor enough? Is Haiti an attractive investment target for a multinational corporation?
Well, the idea was that you could create, and it was an emergency plan, the Collier Report, that you could create in 2 years 100,000 jobs. I doubt that you can do that. One of the problems that Haiti, even for that kind of program, was that we don't have enough electricity. The infrastructure is very weak. So the advantage, if you look at the world economy, is really indeed very, very cheap labor. But anything that would, to some extent, shake the politics in Haiti would eventually, I think, lead to an exodus of even those small investments in the country. I think that that program ultimately, when it was barely implemented, I don't think it would have made a huge difference. I don't think it would have changed fundamentally the course of Haitian history. It's very much more of the same, and the rural areas would have been neglected, and the vast majority of Haitians, I think, would have been left out. Actually, there was an attempt at one point to increase the minimum wage, and that was defeated because the argument was that you can't do that. If you do that, you're not going to have the modest investments for the small industries in the urban areas of Port-au-Prince. So the minimum wage, which was supposed to be increased to $5 a day, was left at about $3 American dollars.
Now, as I recall, also, you argue that Haiti does not have a classical bourgeoisie, that is, it's not a productive capitalist class that's interested in extracting profit through production. It's just a class that has gotten rich off looting, right?
Yes, I mean, I think it's a very unproductive bourgeoisie. It's basically export, import. You don't really have that kind of productive bourgeoisie generating industrial development or even generating investment within the country. It is a crypto bourgeoisie, as it were. There are a few elements within it in the last few years who have tried something, but this is a very small group, and they are not the dominant group at the moment.
And back to Lavalas, which is the grouping that really brought Aristide to power. But as I recall, you said that they're not really very well organized in any political sense.
And they're even more disorganized now. What Préval has done is maneuvering in the Haitian political context. He had a party when he was elected, which was called L'Espoir. And what he's done in the past 4 months is created a new party, which is called Unité, Unity. He's opened up the party to all kinds of different politicians. So you have politicians from Lavalas, as well politicians from the right wing, and politicians from Christian groups, etc. So you have a very peculiar kind of political party. The idea was to regroup everyone. But the way it was done was, to a large degree, by payoffs. I mean, the typical patronage-client relationship that exists in Haiti. And so some key members of Lavalas actually were members now of the cabinet. And other factions are fighting each other while Aristide is still in South Africa. And one of the problems for Lavalas is that Lavalas, to a large degree, was Aristide, to put it, and you have to put that in the strong sense of the term. So the leadership within Lavalas is virtually absent. There are people who were completely overwhelmed by Aristide's personality and dominance of Haitian politics, and particularly of the Lavalas party itself.
I'm speaking with Robert Faton, who's a professor of political science at the University of Virginia. And I guess let's start thinking about how Haiti is going to emerge from this horrendous disaster. What about the configuration of forces now that are moving in, supposedly to help? Who's on the ground, who is coming, and what particularly is the United States about to do?
Well, it's very clear now, whether you like it or not, that the U.S. is in control. The government in Haiti has given control of the airport to the U.S. military. So this is the key factor now, the United States. On the other hand, there are other nations that play a quite important role. You have the French, you have the Canadian, and they tend to agree with the United States. And on the other side of it, you have a group of Latin American countries led by Brazil, Argentina, and Chile, who are mostly the countries in MINUSTA. And I think they are trying to balance U.S. power and not let the U.S. dominate the whole scene. But it's very difficult now because, as you know, the key members of MINUSTA were essentially all dead as a result of the earthquake. The headquarters collapsed. So that has left a void that has yet to be filled. And then you have smaller but important nations like Venezuela and Cuba, who are also contributing to the effort. The Cubans have contributed significantly to the health care system in the rural areas of Haiti. And the Venezuelans have contributed by giving access to Haiti. They've given very cheap oil. So those are the main international actors. And in Haiti, it's very difficult to know what is going to happen because it's not even clear now who is alive and who's dead in the different political parties. Most of the members of the government have survived, but it's not clear yet if all of the senators and the members of the opposition are alive and whether their cadres are still alive. So it's really a completely uncharted territory now. What happens, obviously, the rescue operation will have some significant impact on the different political forces. At the moment, most Haitians are simply bewildered, shocked, and they are desperate for assistance coming from anywhere. So for the moment, I don't think there is any other game in town but the U.S. and the U.S. Army, which has the technological capacity to clear the rubble and maybe generate the reconstruction of the port. So in the short term, I think the U.S. will be, not surprisingly, the key actor in Haiti with secondary actors.
Obama gave struck me as a rather dishonest speech the other day when he emphasized the magnanimity of U.S. approaches in these sorts of disasters. What is your guess about what the United States policy is going to be towards Haiti in the coming weeks and months?
That is the big enigma. I mean, one of the fascinating things about this new century is that now when we are talking about foreign assistance and reconstruction, we are inevitably talking about massive military involvement of the U.S. So it's paradoxical to some extent that you have rescue operations, assistance to a devastated country, which is really controlled by the military. If you wish, the civilian wing of American foreign assistance is clearly in the background. Now, what does the United States want in Haiti? It's unclear to me. I assume that they fear chaos, disorder. They fear the possibility of the spread of disease. They fear also migration to Florida and an uncontrollable wave of boat people. So those are the more, if you wish, cynical aspects of the equation. And on the other hand, I think that the American people in general, seeing the pictures of Haiti, feel absolutely terrible about it. And there's been a massive outpouring of funding for Haiti. So it's a mixed bag. Now, what the military will do in Haiti, it's not clear to me. I assume that they will stay for a few months and then will retreat and let the UN take over again. Once the UN is rebuilt, the Minusta forces are rebuilt and you have a new leadership there. I think that the Haitian population at the moment will welcome the U.S., but the U.S. should be careful because the longer troops stay, the more likely you will get an increasing sense of Haitian nationalism. I want us to remember that Haitians, however poor they may be, don't particularly like the idea of having foreign troops on their soil. But the conditions are such now that people accept it and actually probably welcome it, that the U.S. is in town, as it were.
But the history of U.S. involvement in Haiti is hardly inspiring, so what might we expect the United States to do now that they have such a presence in Haiti?
Well, this is... I hope that the past will not be repeated. I do hope that there will be, and this is hoping, obviously, a different way of looking at foreign assistance in Haiti. That the kind of neoliberal regime should not be implanted in a country with such a disaster. I think it would be absolutely, it would be horrible in my view. That doesn't mean that it's not going to be implemented. I think hopefully the Haitian community in the United States, whatever government we have in Haiti, could move U.S. foreign policy and foreign assistance in a more, if you wish, social democratic direction. But that is hoping for the best possible scenario. This is the heart speaking. When you look at it from a cold, analytical perspective, I doubt that's what we are going to see. And that is the frightening thing, because if the policies are not changed, I think we are going to get into a very vicious cycle. On the other hand, Haiti may change. The social relations in Haiti may change, because the earthquake is really the great equalizer. Well, you know, rich people have more means to exit the crisis or even exit the country. Everyone, irrespective of color, irrespective of class, has been affected and devastated. So one of the fascinating things in the past few days is that very wealthy people have been compelled to sleep in the street with very poor people. The kind of social apartheid that traditionally characterization society is breaking down as a result of that catastrophe. So from that kind of devastation, maybe a new solidarity may crystallize. But that is the optimist in me talking. If you look at past history, it may not happen. But that's what, in this moment of real despair, hope is the last thing you want to lose.
Finally, leaving aside all the self-criticism that the rational self would file this sort of thing, but what would the ideal approach to Haiti's reconstruction be? What if we had the proper means and political will? Could we do to turn things around?
Well, I think you need to really help Haitians create functioning state institutions. I'm not talking about a perfect state, far from it, but a government that has the basic institutions so it can provide basic necessities to the population, can provide decent education, can provide food to the population, and is not utterly dependent on the mercy of charity, of international charity. And to do that, you really need state institutions, functioning state institutions, that are capable of generating the planning for a new infrastructure in the country, for the recovery in the agricultural sector. So in my mind, if something could be done that would be extremely positive, is if the United States would pay attention to the rural areas and push in that direction, generate an infrastructure, put people to work in the rural areas to create that infrastructure, the hope business about export-oriented development might be part of the equation, and I don't think it will disappear given the constellation of forces, but an emphasis on the rural areas, the capacity to create irrigation schemes, the reforestation of the country. I think those things, in a new deal, as it were, a tradition of American politics, could be extremely constructive for Haiti and could give to the country some resilience. So I think that would be the best outcome, given what we know about American politics and the American economy. So a new deal in the real American sense could do wonders for Haiti. But this is, you see, Keynesian economics, and I don't know if that's acceptable to the international financial institutions.
And that's the voice of Robert Fatton, a professor of political science at the University of Virginia, author of Haiti's Predatory Republic and several other books on Africa and his country of origin, Haiti. And we could use a new deal for America, too. That would be very nice, but we're not going to get one of those either. Several times he mentioned MINUSTAH, which is the French acronym for the UN Stabilization Force in Haiti. It's composed of about 9,000 military personnel led by the Brazilian army and about 4,000 cops. It was created in 2004, and its mandate extends through the fall of this year. Their headquarters was destroyed by the earthquake, and much of the leadership was killed. MINUSTAH has been criticized as a front for the U.S., Canada, and France to oust the elected leadership of Aristide and keep his followers repressed through military raids and death squads. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with this somewhat more therapeutic bit of music, this Franz Schubert's impromptu Opus 142, number 2, performed by Radu Lipu. Till next week. Bye.